QSO Today, episode 537, Jim Hall, 84 EB. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" This podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. I am sorry that it has taken me so long to put up additional episodes of QSO Today. My schedule around my other responsibilities and the medications that I am still taking for my illnesses often leaves me exhausted in the middle of the day. Fortunately, my nimble CRM system allows me to create a fair amount of automation to pursue new guests to the podcast from my huge list of prospects. With this boost, if I can get the conversations into the proverbial can, then much of the rest of the work to publish new episodes gets easier, even if I'm all ready to sleep. I want to thank you all who still support me in the podcast. I have a lot of resources to share and just need the physical bandwidth to get it out to you. Stay tuned as I now have guests in the pipeline and hope to make a milestone of 600 episodes. Imagine your wife driving 28,000 miles while your strategy to win weekend QSO parties is to cross as many county and state lines as possible. My guest this week is Jim Hall, 84 EB, whose wife Melody drives while he operates, making him a leader in this form of contesting. 84 EB reveals his winning strategy and his ham radio story in this QSO Today. 84 EB, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Jim?
4Z1UG, this is Jim, 84 EB. You're 5'9 here in Tennessee.
Thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Certainly. It began when I was around 9 years old. My parents gave me a Christmas gift that pretty much changed my life forever. One of those Heathkit Jr. electronic lab kits. It was lab number one, as it was called. Model R120, as a matter of fact. And I still have the manual for it, but I don't have the kit anymore. But it had resistors, capacitors, variable and springs for connecting the wires together. And I used to play with that all the time. And the last lab in the kit was an AM transmit with one transistor. I strung a long wire out of the window and was able to talk to my neighbor next door on his AM radio. So I really got into transmitting radio very young. I guess I was a pirate.
Well, that sounds very cool. And you sent me a picture of that, so I'll put that in the show notes page.
Okay.
You have this interest in radio. How did it express itself so that it would lead to an amateur radio license?
Okay, well that's kind of a long story, but I'll get into it. But my first exposure to ham radio was as a shortwave listener, and I had a Heathkit GR64, which I built, which I think a lot of your guests have also started out with, and it was a good radio, even though it drifted quite a bit. It really got me interested in electronics. I really enjoyed that radio. I still have it today.
And did you collect QSL cards from?
I did. And as a matter of fact, my favorite magazine back then was Electronics Illustrated. And they had this contest called Win the World. You would collect QSL cards from hams and shortwave stations, and then they would give out awards once a year. I wanted to win their beautiful console TV set or a trip around the world. I got sixth place, which wasn't bad for a little kid. And I won an Amico R5 solid-state shortwave radio. That was my first ham radio award, I guess you could say, thanks to my Heathkit GR64.
So you built the GR64 when you were, what, 10, 11 years old?
I think I was 13. My parents had a trip overseas, and they gave me something to work on while gone. I built it just a matter of days. I thought it was a lot of fun, a real learning experience.
Did you have friends around you that also had an interest in electronics, or were you kind of the lone soul out there?
I was a little bit of a lone soul. I had a friend that had a CB. We had walkie-talkies and stuff like that. As far as ham radio, I was kind of by myself back then. But in in junior high, my ninth grade teacher, his name was Charles Wallace. He was K9AIU, who's a silent key now. But he mentioned in class that he was a ham radio operator. And I expressed to him that I was really interested in stewing. And he actually invited me over to his house one and showed me his Drake TR-4. And we had a QSO, a single sideband QSO. That's when ham radio was kind of sealed as fate for me. I was hooked. But the person I credit most for getting me into ham radio is my mother. She saw a little article in the newspaper about a ham radio class being taught at a farmhouse near, just outside of town. And her name was Nelda Reefstead. Her call sign was WA9YXZ, also a silent key. And that's where I learned how to be a ham, and I became a novice along with 10 other kids.
What was the hometown?
Champaign, Illinois, Central Illinois, college town. University of Illinois is there.
And your parents, were they associated with the university there?
They were. My father was the civil engineering professor, became department head, and he was well known and respected as an earthquake engineer. Did a lot of consulting worldwide on earthquakes and nuclear power plants, and worked on the Alaskan pipeline, making it earth. So he was really active as an. I guess it was in my DNA that I would become an.
No, it sounds to me like it was inherited. The brain power and the interest, of course, in technology. So there's a story I read in the NCJ article that somehow you ended up with a Model 19 teletype. How did that happen?
Oh, that was a really lucky occurrence in my life. And we had a family friend at church. His name was Mr. Krug. And he was a ham, but I don't remember what his first. But when I was 14, he gave me his teletype machine. It was pristine. It was a Model 19. Had the punch tape. Everything worked. An amazing piece of it. And as a shortwave listener, I knew that there was radio teletype signals out there waiting to be decoded. So I hunted around the magazines, and I learned that there was this company in my town, Champaign-Urbana, that made radio teletype demodulator called HAL Devices. I went ahead and ordered their little kit for like $59, I think it was. I built this demodulator up, and it was able to decode the teletype. But I needed help because I couldn't get the filters tuned quite right for 170 or 850. And so I called up the place, and I talked to one of the three owners. His name was Bill Henry, K9GWT. It's a silent key too. And he tuned the filters up for me there at HAL. He was impressed with my construction skills, probably because of my Heathkit experience. And one evening he called me and asked me if I wanted to work there as a part-time student per se. So I jumped at that chance. And that teletype machine had a lot to do with my future, that's for sure.
I'm curious. I remember somehow those HAL devices, teletype decoders, because there were two filters, right? There was the Mark and the Space filter.
Correct. They used 88 millihenry toroids.
That's right. Yep. Right. I was going to ask you if they used the 88 millihenry toroids. So what you're tuning then is the C portion of that in order to make that work.
That's correct. And we would take windings off the toroids as well. So it was a real balancing act. It was kind of tricky. And I must say I got rather good at it. And I actually started out in the shipping. And this is an interesting story. We would ship kits and we would ship parts. You could order diodes and everything. It was pretty amazing. Lots of kids, lots of hams. Everybody was a ham. And one day when I was shipping equipment out, the sheet that I was using went missing. So we had my boss had to go and fill out this huge long list of all the orders and all that. And we were back and running again. But then about a month later, my boss called me into his office and he showed me and he said, "You shipped the list to Alaska." And he was not happy about it. And pretty much I got fired from shipping and I got sent over to engineering. The best thing that happened.
So funny.
Yeah, I ended up servicing radio teletype demodulators, ST5 and SE6. I would get the kits in that people tried to build and then I would have to fix them. Saw a lot of really bad soldering.
Now, HAL Devices, they had a large catalog of products that they sold?
Not really. They had ID senders for 2-meter repeaters and CW oscillators. And I'd say they had about maybe a dozen to 20 things that they sold. I was only there for 3 or 4 years, and they went on from. And a lot of the people I worked with that were hams got their license the same time I did, and some of them I still keep in contact with. It was a really fun bunch of people, and I learned a lot. But HAL was a great company, and they did a lot for the youth in our community.
It was this experience with HAL Devices that helped you choose what you might do after high school?
Oh, certainly it did. Yeah. It's kind of a long story, but I I ended up in electrical computer engineering in the end, but it was a long, long trip getting there. I started out in biomedical engineering, which was mostly pre-med students. It was very, very difficult. And they said that, look, when I remember the first day there, they said, look to your left and then look to your right. One of you won't be here. I said, oh, no problem. And it was a problem. So I didn't do so well. My study habits to pull it off. But I think part of the problem I had was that I when I was in high school, I think I spent a lot more time on the radio at 3 a.m. than studying. So my study habits were. But nevertheless, I ended up transferring to the University of Kansas in Lawrence, and I got a degree in civil engineering there. And then I was always interested in geology, and I went and got a master's degree in geotechnical back at Illinois. I went back to Illinois and got a master's degree in civil. And after that, I worked for 3 or 4 years for a consulting company in New York City and Chicago and Kansas City, working on foundations and dams and tunnels and that kind of stuff. Fascinating work. And the economy took a downturn in around 1989. And I ended up working in hazardous waste for the day. And I really didn't like it too much.
Because of your exposure to hazardous waste in the process?
Well, partly. And it just wasn't that exciting to me. But when I was working there, I bought a Heathkit H89. And I just got totally enthused and programming computer systems. I wrote an interface for RTTY with my computer. And I actually applied it at work quite a bit, some of the work I was doing there. But I knew that electronics was really where my heart was. So I went back to Illinois again. I got a master in EE, which took me 2 years in control system. So it took me a long time to get there.
So then where did you go with that, with the master's in electrical engineering and control systems?
Yeah, it was I interviewed with a lot of companies, TRW, McDonnell Douglas. They were hiring like Lockheed, HP, and others. And I took a job with Boeing in Seattle. But during the last week of school, another company showed up really late to the interview process. It came in kind of like a back door. And it was the Saturn Corp, the car manufacturer out of Michigan. It's a subsidiary of General Motors. They had just gotten formed like in the last couple of months. And they interviewed, and I interviewed with them, and I accepted a job with them. I told Boeing I'm going to come, and they were fine with that. And I ended up taking a job with the Saturn Corporation on the ground floor.
So I remember that car. What was unique about that car that they would create a separate corporation around?
Well, it was GM was having a really hard time competing with the small car market. And there were a lot of things that GM knew they had problems with, and they wanted to kind of change their culture or have a group change the culture and try to do something different. So our motto was a different kind of car, a different kind of company. And what made Saturn unique as far as the vehicle goes, we used plastic panels, and they would have commercials where they'd have grocery carts run into the side of vehicles and they'd bounce right back, which is true. And the paint job was really, but it was a different kind of company. And GM, they put in $5 billion for in Spring Hill, which is my hometown really. And that would be about $15 billion in company. It was a big deal. It was kind of top secret. And I think the plant ended up as 4 million square feet. And they built the entire vehicle, all the gears and shafts and engine parts and plastic panels, every bit of the car, except maybe the windshield and the seats, were all made here in Spring Hill in this plant. We produced 1,200 cars a day. We got everything running. That's about one a minute for almost 7 days a week. We cranked out the cars.
Oh, amazing.
It was amazing. It was.
So as a control engineer, then your job was you know, wiring up manufacturing processes and stuff, or?
Yeah, well, I had a really interesting career there. I was on the ground floor, and let me back up a little bit. When I showed up to Saturn on the first day, which was September 16th, 1985, they had no record of my employment or anything about me. I walked in the door for orientation, and they said, "Who are you?" It was shocking, and it was a mess. But luckily, I had this letter from one of the engineering manager that showed that I was supposed to be hired, and I was okay because of that letter. And there was another engineer there that was starting on this, but he had been, Bob Helm was, and he told me, "Don't worry about anything. You can come work for me for a while. I'll take care of you. Don't worry about it." So he kind of put his arm around me and kind of make things work. And the deal was he said, "What I want you to do is go to every single group in the corporate body shop, paint shop, engines, transmissions, general assembly, injection molding, and decide who you want to work with, what group you want in." I could go anywhere I wanted in the hand. It was amazing. And I chose general assembly because it was going to be almost a lights out kind of tons of automation. It didn't turn out that way, but that's what kind of drew me to.
And you were there how many years?
In total, I stayed till the end, and then I came back a little bit later. And I ended up working there for about 35 years total, my whole career, pretty much doing a lot of the same things.
And did they continue to make the Saturn car all with during that 35 years, or Or did it turn into something else along the way?
It kind of died. Same time GM went bankrupt. It's kind of a sad story, but I think they stopped building Saturns and then GM went bankrupt and at that time, or just before that, and they had to shed themselves of a couple of brands. So Saturn and Pontiac and Hummer, they were discontinued.
And that was what, 2008 when they...
Yeah, 2009 is when
2009.
Yeah. It was an amazing place to work. And the brand was really popular and the cars were super high quality. We had a homecoming winter at Saturn and 50,000 Saturn owners showed up to our home. We had concerts and fireworks and all that kind of stuff. It was a tremendous brand and a real shame. We were heartbroken. We had to stop doing there. But anyway, on my getting back to what I did there, I was involved in controls and also the IT end. I was in a group called Plant Floor System, which was a combination of control systems on the manufacturing floor and then the IT systems that would kind of run the plant. And I worked on a system or helped develop a system called, it was a plant monitoring control. And it was co-developed with GE Fanuc in Albany, where my wife worked. I met her there the first time and she ended up moving down to Spring Hill and worked in the same group I did, Plant Floor System. It was a great career and I really enjoyed it. I stayed technical the whole time.
What did you do in ham radio during that period of time? Were you an active ham in those days?
I was active. I kind of really tried a lot of radio. I was really into CW when I was a novice, but with that teletype machine, I was big into RIDI. So I would even do rag shoes on RIDI for years. And RIDI was alive and well back. I got involved with PSK-32, satellite communication. I talked to the Mir space station and some of the shuttles. And I did meteor scatter for a while, which was a fascinating way to use radio. I had one moon bounce QSO. And then throughout my whole ham radio career, I'd hear these things on the radio where there'd be just so many stations. And I would work, I don't know, 10 stations in a few minutes sometimes. But I wrote them all on my ARRL log. I'd have sheets and sheets and sheets of all these stations I worked in a rapid fire order. That was my first introduction to contest. I didn't really know what it was, but I enjoyed working all the DX and the other stations that were involved.
And what were you using for rigs in those days? You sent me your first rig. Was it the Heathkit HW16 was your first rig?
HW16.
It was mine as well.
I still have that today. Yeah, I just took it out of the attic a couple of days ago to send you a picture of it. I need to restore it. My next radio was Yaesu FTDX100, the precursor to one. Kind of a rare radio.
Uh-huh. Is that one working?
I haven't turned it on in a long time. It's in mint condition. It probably does work, but I need to recap it before I actually try to use it again. I had a Tentec Omni 6 Plus, and then I went to ICOM Pro 3 and a 7600. And then today I have two 70s that I use. So I'm an ICOM guy now.
Well, I'm an ICOM guy too. And
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. Well, so that's very cool. And so now you're retired. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
I'm retired too, and I've never been so busy in my life. Yeah, and I'm sure that you could probably do the same thing. So in your retirement, and you just mentioned that you got a taste of contesting, you're wearing a Contest University t-shirt right now, I can see, as we're talking mm-hmm. on Google Meet. How did you get into contesting, and what was the attraction?
Well, I started working more with these weekend contests, and I started having fun doing it. And so I looked around online, and I found out there was this group called the Tennessee Contest. So I wrote a letter to EG, an email to Kirk, KFRO, and he welcomed me into the TCG group. And I met a lot of the contesters, really active and proficient at it. And that's kind of what drew me in is my early working contest without even knowing I like CW contesting the most, but I also do RIDI sideband as well.
And now this mid-show break. The QSO Today project now has over 500 podcast episodes and hundreds of hours of virtual ham radio expo presentations, all freely available and fully supported by you, the listener. This short message and the later mention of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast are the only breaks in the program. QSO Today has no commercial sponsors, so no one influences the content or direction. This project exists solely to promote amateur radio and the people who make it thrive. Producing QSO Today is like a half-time job. Your support at any level covers the tools, hosting, and production costs that keep it going. And while it is a labor of love, it isn't free. Only about 6% of listeners contribute. please consider making a donation. Use the slider on our donations page to set up the amount that reflects the value that you get from each episode or from our library of educational videos. Make it monthly to help secure the next 500 episodes. You can also become a listener sponsor, shop on Amazon using our referral link, share QSO today with friends, subscribe to our mailing list and YouTube channel, and help spread the word. Every action is value for value. Keep QSO today alive by taking action now. We return to our QSO. Now, would you say that you're a chaser? I mean, I'm not a contester, so I'm if I'm mixing up words that probably belong into poda or soda or something like that, are you the guy sending CQ, or are you the guy that's going after people who are sending CQ?
I'm the guy doing both at the same time. So I'm a SO2R, single operator, two radio. So pretty much whenever I'm CW contesting, I've got two radios, one CQing and the other one searching and pouncing, looking for multipliers. So that's my favorite mode of operating.
Okay, so in operating SO2R, it seems to me that you also have a lot of automation that kind of goes with that in order to make because I think SO2R is you're on two different bands at the same time.
Correct. Yes.
Right.
Always.
So you're managing antennas and trying not to transmit on the same band into your other radio to keep it from.
Correct.
So what kind of automation do you have, and how does that work for you?
Okay. Well, I have two radios, two towers, other antennas, and also have bandpass filter, reduce interference between radios. And I use stepper antennas, so I have to send information to my stepper controllers to tune to the correct band. So there's a lot of stuff going on in these contests running SO2R. And I use Node-RED coordinates. Being a controls engineer, it's kind of right up my alley to figure out to do that. So I have switching relays that I use to actually control the station while I do this SO2R. It's pretty well fully automated as far as it works out pretty slick. So there is a lot of automation making it all work.
And what's going on in your brain when you're doing SO2R? I mean, it seems to me that you're trying to pay attention to two things at the same time. You're trying to keep them in sync. You're trying not to. So I guess I've never asked this question of SO2R operators, but it seems to me that it requires a little bit of coordination between the right brain and the left brain, you know?
It does. Timing is everything with it. And that's the art of SO2R. The goal is to make it so that the people you're talking to have no idea. You never want to make the other guy. So I'm sitting there calling CQ and working people at maybe 112, maybe more. And then at the same time, you got these little windows of opportunity when they're sending. And that's when you go ahead and shoot your call over to them and have that guy work. And then when he's sending his response, you're sending your response. You can't transmit on both of them. Radios of the mess not leave. So you got to time it just right so that I'm sending when he's sending and he's sending when I'm sending. So if you do it all right, it just happens and nobody knows, but you got an extra QSO out of it. So it's intense. It takes a lot of practice, but it makes it a lot more fun. I can't operate contests without it now. It's just not exciting enough. Yeah. It's once you do it and get proficient, it's hard not to do.
Now you're doing this on CW at the same time, right?
Yep.
And is there a speed that seems like this is contest speed? It's comfortable for me. It's comfortable for the people that you're operating. Is, you know, like, is it, it's not fast. Is it 30 words a minute or is it 20 words a minute? Or do you change your speed based on, you know, who you're talking to?
Well, as it turns out, it's better not to your speed, and faster is better. So like in the CWTs that I do every Wednesday, I'm operating at 38 on both the SO2R and the search and pounce, on both the run radio and the. That's a good speed because what happens is when people hear that you're sending it that fast, they usually send it this. And when everybody's sending and receiving at the same speed, you can interlace the calls. And another thing is I also use it with RTTY. I started doing SO2R with RTTY. It is much, much easier with RTTY because the decoding is done for you. But if anybody has an interest in doing SO2R, I'd recommend starting with TY. Learn the ropes with RTTY because it's so easy to get these interlaced and get your rates up to close to 200 an hour with RTTY, but just by having two radios at the same time.
And the RTTY operators come out during these contests? Because
yes.
I kind of tuned up and down the bands looking for RTTY because my little radio has a decoder in it, and I don't find anything. And I'm assuming that, you know, they're all waiting for the next contest.
That's right. It used to be there were plenty all the time, but now it's only on the contest. So you come in on one of the big RITI contests and the bands are loaded with RITI operators. It's very popular these days. It's really pretty amazing. It's really alive and well. Sideband, I don't do SOTN. I maybe a little bit. It's very difficult. It takes a lot of skill.
It prevents dementia in your old age.
That's one of the reasons I do it. Yep.
It keeps those synapses close together.
That's correct. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Now, one of the things I read in the contest and the NCJ article about you is that you also do mobile contesting. How did that start? How did you get involved in contesting your mobile? And it seems to me that you do some unusual things there as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like my new ham radio hobby is mobile contesting. New since 2009, but still new. But I never really thought I'd do. I did a little bit of mobile rag shoe with a ICOM 706 I had in the car. I did that a little bit. But there's two guys in the TCG, W4NZ Ted and N4ZZ Don, and they had done a mobile competition a couple of weeks earlier. And Ted's been doing it for a long time, but it was the first time for Don, who's a friend of mine here. And Don told me that you have to set your van up to do mobile contesting because there's nothing like it. And so I thought about it and I said, sure, I can do that. So I put together a station in our Montana van, which was fairly new. And now it has almost 300,000. That's what got me started. These two guys put a bug in my head to it. So I did my first mobile contest with Don. It was the Tennessee QSO party in 2009 and we came in second place, but we had a ball doing. And I was hooked big time. The pileups were amazing. It was like being on a remote island. The pileups. I was sucked in. Started a long future mobile contesting.
Did you have the van and you decided to start contesting, or when you got interested in mobile contesting, you bought the van?
I had the van.
You had the van already. So it was just kind of adapting what you already had for this new experience.
That's correct. I was starting from scratch. And my wife and I knew I had to put a table in this van. The seats in the middle came out, but I had to get some kind of a table. And we just happened to be at the local recycling center dump, you could call it. And we were throwing stuff in the dumpster. And sure enough, there was this crate in there and a piece of wood that was the same size as a desktop. And I jumped in there, which you're not supposed to do. And I grabbed those two items and built a table in the van for holding the radio, my computers, and my other gear, thinking it would be a one-time thing. And here I am, still using it 17 years later, still have the same table. It's worked out really good. It's really, really sturdy and stable and holds you really well.
Now, it's my understanding that your wife is also technical and she's also a ham radio operator.
She is a ham. She became a member of our Aries group here, and she thought that would help her with emergency preparedness and stuff. So she went ahead and got her technician, and she had one QSO, and that's it. But she really, she has a license, but she's non-active.
But she plays a very unique support role for you in your mobile contesting. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought that was kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, she's a Melody's. She's a remarkable. And her and I are like two peas in a pod, you could say. We met at work, and when we both retired in 2009, about the same time. She was a little bit earlier, but I got called back as a consultant, and she came back at the same time, and we worked together side by side for years as consultants for putting an engine plant. So her and I have worked together and collaborated on things as long as we've known each other, and we needed a driver for QSO party, and she volunteered to be our driver. And she's been driving me in these contests ever since. She supports my hobby just 100% behind it.
It seems to me, Jim, that you could drive the van out to the boonies yourself, and then you could sit behind the table and you could operate. But you're doing something different. What's the strategy of your operation and Melody's role in her driving?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. Well, the goal in these QSO parties is to work as many people as you can, get the biggest number. And you can do really well by being stopped and operating and then driving yourself to the next county and do the same thing. But you're missing all that time where you could be making a tremendous number of QSOs. So we're in motion pretty much the entire time. And some of these contests are like 10 hours on Saturday and 10 hours on Sunday. And she's driving sometimes over 1,000 miles in these, just so that we can get to the next county and the next county in a short amount of time and as many people as possible. So we're on the move almost all the time.
So if you go into another county, then you can work that station again, right?
That's the beauty of mobile contests, state QSO parties, is that you get to pretty much work the whole contest over again every time you go to a new county. So you get these tremendous pileups, county after county after county, as you enter them. It's amazing. For somebody like me that loves pileups and high-speed Morse code, it's a dream.
So then you have a strategy for participating in these QSO parties, and then that strategy includes a route that Melody drives in order for you to maximize the number of QSOs that you make?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. That's one of the keys to our success is the planning ahead of time. I'll spend sometimes 2 weeks planning out the route, minute to minute in most cases. We'll have the whole route planned out, how much time we're going to spend in each county. And the route is a key part of the whole thing. You want to try to get 15 or 20 minutes in each county. And the best thing you can do is to find a county where you just go through the corner, where it only takes you a few minutes to get through. But then you can stop in that county and operate while not in motion, which is sometimes the best. You get the best rates that you're not jostling around in the car. And you can find a nice, quiet RF location, too, when you do that. So it's all laid out. And I put a schedule together in Excel that pretty much lays it out for me exactly which turns to make, where we're going to stop, what side of the road we're going to be, where we're going to get gas, where we're going to get antennas. Pretty much the whole thing is laid out in a schedule. And it's all loaded into a GS to the route. So she just has to follow the GPS and it'll take her where she needs to go. And she can enjoy the scenery and we don't have to worry about making it to the contest county because we know.
Okay, so then let me ask the fundamental question that I should have asked at the beginning is that for those of us who are I haven't lived in America for 26 years now, so I don't even know what a QSO party is. So what is a QSO party and why should people who can participate because of their location, why should they participate in it?
Yeah, I guess we should have started there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it. But most states put on their own QSO parties and it's a worldwide event. Anybody can enter a state's QSO. It's not just, and most states have their own party, but some of them combine their parties together, like the New England QSO party is a good example. The New England states get together and have their QSO party, which is a pretty big one. And the rules of the contest, depending on if you're in state or out of state, that's what makes the difference. If you're out of state, you try to work as many stations within the QSO party state as you can and work as many counties as you can with state. Stations that are located in the QSO party state, they can work everybody. And their score is the number of QSOs, and they have multipliers, states, provinces, and usually countries. So the goals are different depending on in-state or out-of-state. But the mobiles have the huge advantage because you get to work everybody over and over and over again. You can get huge scores. I remember in the Florida QSO party in 2025, I ended up with over 4,000 QSO in the two 10-hour days. That's averaging over 200 an hour for the whole contest. After log checking, it was just below 4,000. It was our best score to date. 200 an hour for 20 hours in a car, mind-boggling. Really, it's really, really fun.
How are you logging these? I mean, I remember from QSO Today interviews that it used to be that when you worked someone in the contest, you'd take your logs and you'd send your logs into the AARRL or all of your QSL cards and you'd send those in and they would, essentially score those based on the people that you worked. How do you do that now? I mean, so that you confirm that you actually worked people on both sides.
Well, that's a really good question. I use N1MM as a contest log, and it ties into my computer in my car, my laptop, and I log mine up. It keeps track of time, frequency, what state, province, or country they're at, and the frequency. And the other person does the same thing on his side. He logs it all to a logging program as well. And those logs are a Cribillo files and they're sent to the contest director and they use software to cross-check it all to make sure that everything lines up. When you say you work this guy at this time and this was the exchange that he has this and it's done, the checking is a big part of it, but thanks to automation, it's not an undaunting. Speaking of N1MM, you asked what got me into contesting. I'd have to say that N1MM, that software package is what got me on testing because I was just logging in my log sheet for that. But when I got N1MM logger when it first came out, it changed everything. I became a contesting maniac because of it made it so much fun. And as a matter of fact, we have this award. This is off topic. We have this award in the Tennessee contest group called the Most Radioactive. And Don, N4ZZ, he would win it year after year after year. And I was a brand new member of TC and just getting in a contest. And I set a goal that year that I was going to beat Don. So I entered every CW, RTTY, sideband contest almost every weekend, whole year, to try to get up to what he was doing. And I did it. I ended up with 35,000 QSOs and just inch over him. It was like a horse race the whole time. He didn't know who I was from Adam, and I hadn't met, but I was going after him. And we became best friends after that and still are very competitive today. I've done a lot of mobile QSO parties with him as a partner. He's a great guy and an excellent contester. Anyway, that's it.
Is there a leaderboard for these QSO parties? Is there a way in real time you can actually, while they're not confirmed, you know, by the contesting authority, but is there a way to actually see how you're doing in real time against other operators?
Yeah, there's a couple things with that. There's the live scores that you probably heard, see how your fellow competitors are doing. And I always I use my phone as a hotspot in the car, so I send my scores to, and I can see some of the other mobile contesters there as well. But the really neat thing going on right now is a thing called the APRS Live QSO Party Tracker. K2UA, Russ is pushing that really hard along with some other people. But people at home can log into their computer and have a browser up where they can monitor the locations and counties of all the mobiles that are using APRS. It makes it a game. It's a game changer for mobile contesting. And it's really gotten popular in the last couple months is that you at home can track us live and see where we've been, full trail. It's got a lot of attention.
On the one hand, on the other hand, it might betray, you know, the route that you've spent 2 weeks building as a contest strategy, perhaps.
That's true too, but I try to promote the hobby, I guess you could say. I think the more people that come after me or try to follow my routes, for example, the better. So I actually post my routes on my YouTube so people can see them ahead of time, and they can look at them afterwards to see where I was.
Have you taken new or young hams on board with you in the van while Melody's driving around, and you can actually demonstrate or share the contest with somebody who, you know, might get hooked?
I certainly have. That's a very timely question, actually. There's a ham in West Tennessee. His name's Ryan, AC4NK, brand new ham. I think he got his license a year ago and learned CW. I think he started learning CW in January. And I worked him in a CWT mini test. He sent me an email, said, I'm a brand new ham. I'm just learning Morse code. Do you have any ideas on how I can do better and what to do? And I told him to join the Tennessee contest group and do the slow speed test and the medium speed test. Gave him a lot of ideas on things to do. And sure enough, he became really good in a short amount of time. And I bumped into Ryan at Dayton, and he expressed an interest in doing the Tennessee QSO party with me mobile. I was kind of shocked. Are you ready for that? So I said, well, I'll tell you what. I invited him to go to the Kentucky QSO party. It was 3 weeks ago. And he and I teamed up as a multi-op in the van. I got a nice route through Kentucky. It was 12 hours long. And he did great. He was like a seasoned professional. He was operating at 38 words a minute in the pileups. Just a remarkable, very skillful. He is hooked into mobile contesting. So yeah, I've had one young ham. I guess he's 30. I guess that's young.
Yeah.
For us older people, but he really loved. I've had a few other people, but not many youth so far. But that's one of the things I want to do is try to get more people to experience what I've doing mobile.
Gamifying the contest seems to be something perhaps that might interest younger people who are into games, for example.
Oh, yeah, I think that's, I support that 100%.
What do you use as a contest rig in the van? Do you take one of the stations, one of the radios out of your SO2R station, or have you created a dedicated rig for mobile contest?
I use one of my ICOM 7610s for mobile contesting. I just take it out of the shack and put it in the van. When I do mobile contesting, I often do SO2V, single operator 2VFOs. So while I'm CQing, I'm also, if I see a really important multiplier show up, I'll try to work on the second. It can be very productive. Like in the Florida contest, at the end of the contest, each multiplier was worth about 50 contacts. So it was worth the time to try to work in DX and try to do that at the same time you're running. You can only do that when things slow down a little bit. It's hard to do it when it's worth the time.
Do you have a contesting philosophy then that you could share with the listeners in terms of, you've evolved over time, but it seems to me that there's something that's pushing you, driving you to these heights and the success.
Well, I think I'm always trying to beat myself, my last score. And, so I think the philosophy is just to do better every time and find ways to make things a little bit more efficient while you're operating. I use a lot of auto hotkey where I can reprogram keys on my keyboard to different things. So I used to have to reach to my radio to change filters or to control the RIT, do various other things on the radio. I converted those to hotkeys where I just hit shift and a letter. It does it for me automatically. So I do a lot of programming in software to help me be more efficient on the radio.
I see. Will you send CW using hotkeys?
Yes, I do send CW too. Mm-hmm. The N1MM has all the macros already for sending. I don't use the hand keyer very often, but I do use the hotkeys for controlling the second, especially. If you look on, I think I'll add it to my cures. I'll put it on your show notes page. I have a picture of what my screen looks like on my computer in the car. So I'll send that to you. You can post that, see what it looks like. I also have an audio file I can send you of what it sounds like on my end. I'll send you that as well.
Sure. I'll put that in the show notes page. I'm using AI now to generate the show notes. So if people are seeing the show notes from the last few episodes, then they'll see that there's a lot of references and stuff like this. Are you using AI at all in helping you either create contest routes or anything else?
Not yet. I mean, we can't help but not use AI for my biggest friend in the route planning is Google Earth. I mean, when I plan these routes out, I zoom in and see what the parking areas look like. Sometimes I operate on county lines, for example. I got to make sure there's a county line sign there. So I'll use Google Earth to take me down and look at locations where I'm going to be stopped and look at the quality of the roads. But not AI yet, but you got me kind of thinking there a little.
I have mixed feelings about it. I'm using it a lot now, and I've even built myself a Hermes agent running on a server in Finland. And sometimes I think that some of these projects I'm doing are taking me days longer because I'm using AI, and then it will apologize to me, you know, after I've spent a day spinning my wheels, and goes, "Oh, well, that's a very good point that you're making. Perhaps we could have..." Somehow I think, Mr. AI, that I think that this project would have been easily done if I just not used AI. And then he'll come back and he'll agree with me. Well, yeah, you know, there's something to what you're saying. So,
yeah. Well, I haven't tried it.
It's like having really somebody sitting next to you in the office here on the one hand. On the other hand, he's giving you a bunch of bad advice. I'm enjoying that as well. And I'm always thinking of, well, how do I add this to my ham radio activity?
Well, I spend so much time planning the route. I haven't yet tried just letting AI take a shot at it. Find the best route in the show party for 20 hours and see what happens.
What you could do is you could compare it to a QSO party that you've already done. So a route that you've already driven to see whether or not it would come up with a similar route. And you already know what the boots on the ground look like.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, that would be fun. Do you have a ham radio workbench?
I do. I'm sitting at it right now. I don't really have a lot of projects, but I do have a workbench. I have the typical voltmeters and power supplies and all that. But lately, I've been doing a lot more operating the station building type thing.
Now, I see on the shelf above your shoulder, they look like crash helmets, but we established at the beginning, before we started recording, that you fly helicopters.
That's correct. Yeah, that's one of my other hobbies, long time hobby, since I was, I guess, 20 years old. I've been flying airplane, later helicopters. But those are helicopters I use for competition. They're about 4 feet long, and they do about 60 to 70 miles an hour typically. And I do precision aerobatics, and we have local competitions, and there's national competitions as well in Indiana. So I used to spend a lot more time doing helicopter practice and competing than a ham radio. Lately, I've kind of put those on the back burner, and I've really spent a lot more time doing contesting.
When you do fly those helicopters, are you flying them like you see the guys with the RC remote control? So you're actually looking in the sky and watching your helicopter, or
That's
are
correct.
You using a camera in the front of it and you're experiencing the helicopter as if you're the pilot?
Yeah, we're watching these from the ground. It's not FPV type stuff. FPV, it's on the ground watching, and we're drawing figures in the sky basically, and doing some fairly tricky maneuvers at the same time. In the competitions, we'll have five or six guys sitting behind us that'll be watching every single we make and see. There's a planned schedule and some freestyle stuff too, but they look at how accurately you do your maneuvers. They have world competitions. It's really big in Japan and Germany and Europe. Not so big here in the U.S., but it's really, really big. And a lot of guys spend a lot of time and money in perfecting this other hobby.
Have you crashed a helicopter?
I've crashed some, but not very often. There's
a certain amount of the risk is that you crash them and you have to either rebuild them or toss them. I guess that my unlike ham radio, my concern would be that when you crash them, it's a new story. You know,
it's a new story. But I've been really lucky. I usually don't exceed my. I work up to I. I take time with getting my skill level to be to do so. I shouldn't say that, but I do rarely crash. But it does happen on occasion, and rebuilding is part of the hobby.
That's right. And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. Is there something about ham radio that you're not doing that you've been thinking about doing and there's just some push that will, you know, take you there? Is there something about the hobby that you think that you'd like to do that you're not doing?
I don't think so. I think I've kind of found my niche. I think mobile contesting where it's at. And also I've done some multi operating too, which
I got the impression you said earlier that your wife was involved in some of the ARES type activities in the area. Are you involved in those activities as well?
No, and neither is Melody at this point. We haven't been doing that. We got into it for a short time, but we haven't done much to bring that forward.
Well, it seems to me that the QSO parties, just the planning of the QSO parties and the number of them, it seems to me that they're prolific, right? There could be a QSO party every other weekend or...
Yeah, there pretty much is a QSO party every week, but I usually, it takes a lot of planning and gas is kind of expensive, you probably know, but I kind of have honed in on about 6 QSO parties that I really enjoy. I like the bigger ones that have a lot of participation, and I usually end up doing the same ones over and over again. I think I've done 52 QSO parties so far today. That's how many I've done.
Have you thought about this in terms of promoting amateur radio to the general public? Is there something in QSO parties that could be that thing to talk about with the non-ham radio public? I mean, when you're on the road in your van, I'm sure that you might get some looks.
Oh, I get a lot of looks, and I get stopped sometimes too. But that's the difference. But I think one thing that is starting to take shape with the popularity of POTA is combining, getting more POTA people involved in at the same time. And if a guy happens to be in a park on the same weekend as a QSO party, he's going to get inundated with people wanting to find out what county he's. So I think combining those two things will be good. And the nice thing about POTA is that they're out in the open. People will come by and they can explain what's going on and talk about QSO parties. And I think POTA might be a good way to advertise QSO parties.
It sounds to me like POTA and QSO parties, perhaps they're not thinking that they're mutually, that there could be some mutual benefit. So there isn't that bridge yet between the two. I mean, I could see N1 and NM having some kind of a module that says, hey, you know, you're operating POTA today. Well, there's also a QSO party. Here's how you can be in both, or some kind of, you know, the leaderboard you were talking about. It seems to me that maybe there's a way that maybe there's a lot of POTA operators that just don't know about QSO parties.
I think that's true. I think there are a lot of POTA people that don't know about QSO parties. I was at Contest University at Dayton this year, and there was a presentation on POTA and QSO parties at the same time. Mm-hmm. AJ gave that NK4W, I think. No, I can't remember his call, but it's AJ down in Florida. He gave a great presentation on on POTA and how it can blend in with QSO parties.
Is there something that we could be doing better to attract new or even returning hands?
That's a really, really good question. I mean, part of the problem is, let me think about this. Hold on a minute. Well, let's try it again from the beginning. One thing I've done a lot of, this is like my eighth presentation this 2 years. So I've done a lot of a club. I've been zoomed into a lot of clubs and actually went to a lot of clubs to present things at QSO parties, trying to get people involved that way. But I don't know if that really matches your question.
Well, it's kind of like, Contest University at Dayton is, I've never participated, but I know people that have. You've got the best contesters combined with the people that really want to know about it on the one hand. On the other hand, the majority of people that might be interested in it, never get to Dayton or never get to Contest University. And I found this with the QSO Today Virtual Ham Expo, that there are a lot of people that just, never leave home, that are anxious for information to be able to participate in the hobby in a different way than they have been doing it for the last, number of years. And boy, I don't know where I'm going with this. So
I do.
Forgive me, because I know what I'm thinking, but I'm not sure how I'm saying it right.
Yeah, I thought about this a little bit. Don't record this, but you asked about what advice would you give to returning hams. That's
right.
Your question. And I was going to tell them to try different things. And if you find yourself not enjoying some aspect of ham radio, search around and find something else. And you can use YouTube to learn about something new and give it a try.
Right.
And also,
right.
I want to stress that they need to join their local club or any club for that. And I really kick myself nowadays for not doing that more when I was young. I feel like I missed out on a lot of ham activity and friendships by not joining clubs when I really should have.
So let's go back a little bit then I'll know where to where to cut this or where to do this. Are you involved in a ham radio club or clubs now where you're an active member and you go to meetings?
I am, actually. We have a brand new local ham radio club hometown, Spring Hill Thompson Station. And we have 10 members right now, 10 due paying members who come to meetings on Thursdays once a month. And there's only 10 of us, but we really have a very interesting meeting every month. And most of the members in the club are big into POTA. That's what they do, is POTA. They don't know much about contesting whatsoever, but three of them right now are in CW Academy, Morse code. And I've had two of them so far to show them what contesting can be, and they're kind of taking to it. So we're starting to get some interest here locally. The president of our club last week, he went to the FCC database and found that we have 130 hams in our area, in our town. It's of about 80,000 people. And he tried to send letters to each of them to invite them to field day with this weekend. And he found out that there were only about 30 of them that had their emails on QRZ.com. So he wasn't able to contact them, but those that he did, he invited them to come to our field day and hopefully get them more active. So I do belong to a local club here in Middle Tennessee.
I did notice in QRZ that you can actually search their database by zip code. So you can actually find the mail addresses you could send out postcards, because if you're looking for hams in your neighborhood, boy, I think you'd be surprised at the number of licensed hams that are in a single zip code. As you say, you found 130 licensed amateurs from the FCC database who are around you. But unfortunately, we might have to go back to that old-fashioned way of sending messages, and that's, drop a bunch of cards at the post office.
I don't think we've thought of that, but you're right.
And it's expensive, from what I understand. It's not 8 cents to mail a card anymore. It's $1.08, or it's actually quite expensive, but... Or driving around and knocking on doors, you could almost, do that. Were you always active in ham radio clubs? And if not, why weren't you always active in ham radio clubs?
Well, that's one thing I really regret about my ham radio journey, that I was not active in clubs early on. I think I was too shy. I'm not really sure, but I didn't get into contesting until 20 years ago. But really, I should have got into contesting after my first field day about 50. And I really kicked myself for that. So I would encourage any new ham to please join a club, in any club, local or not, just do it. That's one of my biggest regrets in ham radio is not doing it.
Is there advice that you'd give to newer returning hams then? based on your over 50 years of experience in ham radio?
Well, I think one thing I would tell them is to try different things, try different aspects of ham radio. If you don't really enjoy it, try something else. Don't give up on ham radio. And that you've got this great resource called YouTube, and you can just enter ham radio and you come up with a plethora of different things you can do in ham radio for young people as well as more experienced people.
As a YouTube addict, I can tell you that I agree 100%. I think YouTube is one of the fastest ways to learn about anything in ham radio. So SO2R, I bet that there's probably a lot of SO2R YouTube videos.
Oh, there are. And there's also another new thing in contesting is 2BSIQ, two-band synchronous interlaced QSOs. I don't know if you heard of that.
But no.
It's like SO2R on steroids, where every QSO is interlaced, and you can get rates up 100 contacts that way. Very few people can do it, but those that do it can really...
So are they really doing it, or are they using computers to actually do all of the...
The brain's doing it.
Really?
They can carry on two conversations at once. There's some great YouTube videos, 2BSIQ. It's worth checking out. I've dabbled in it, but I can't do it. It takes a certain mind to be able to. Now on RIDI, go ahead. Okay, I was going to say on radio teletype, it's easy, much easier to do 2BSIQ on teletype because you don't have to decode in your head. It's much harder on or sideband.
Jim, is there something that we haven't touched on that we should touch on in our QSO today?
Well, let me think for a second. Okay, let me look at my notes.
So here's what we'll do and this is true of every QSO today guest, and that is that I found that every one of my guests is happy to field questions or be contacted directly. If someone has a question, how would they reach you, Jim? We won't put your email address in the show notes because then you'll become the target of spam. But anybody looking you up on QRZ, who has a QRZ login, can probably get your email address if they want to send you a message and ask you a question.
Oh, that's correct. Yeah, you can contact me through my QRZ webpage. And in fact, on that page, I have a link to a presentation. My 2025 contest university presentation is on there. So if you want to learn everything I know about mobile contesting, you can watch that video and you'll learn a lot from that. But if you have any other questions, yes, please feel free to contact me by email, and I'll be glad to help you out any way that I can.
And I'll put as many of Jim's resources on the show notes page so that if you go into the QSO Today show notes page and search by call sign, then in this case, AD4EB, then look it up and you'll find those resources there. And those links should be working based on the hours I've spent fine-tuning the AI bot that goes through and actually builds that portion of the show notes page. Jim, what a pleasure. I hope that you enjoyed this experience as much as I did.
Oh, I certainly did. And we've missed you. I'm a regular listener to your podcast for at least 10 years, maybe longer. And there's been a big pause since I think Marty was the last one you had.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've missed you, and we're glad to have you back. And I'm glad to do this. And one more thing I want to say is that I owe my mobile contest success to Melody, my wife. She has been an incredible trooper on this whole adventure and has done so many, 28,000 miles, I think, in these contests. But she has done so much to support my hobby in the mobile contest as well as here at home. And I have two big towers in my yard of 0.4 acres, and I have great neighbors. But she calls them her lawn ornament. And she's been just a wonderful wife. I wouldn't be enjoying this hobby as much.
Well, you know what? If you have a spouse that supports, it's so much easier than if you have a spouse that doesn't support. I'm also lucky. My spouse knows where I am. I'm in my office, or I'm in my office ham shack QSO Today production department. So as a result of that, she's been very supportive, and that really helps if you're pursuing a hobby like this. With that anyway, Jim, before I go off on my soapbox, Jim, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. 73. That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Jim. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qso.com QSOtoday.com and put an 84EB, that's Alpha Delta 4 Echo Bravo, in the search box at the top of the page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes page. I am grateful for any way that you show your appreciation and support. It makes a big difference. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.